Good morning and welcome once again to Manzanita Voices, the program for people who love the written word. Hope you had a great week, and I'm very glad that you're back with us today. I'm your host, Linda Field, and my guests today on the show are going to be Mary Lynn McGrath and her husband, Robin Aurelius. They are the founders of Straight Talk Storytellers that meet the first Wednesday of every month in Sacramento at the Avid Reader Bookstore. We'll be talking with them in just a few minutes, but first, it's time for Date Book. So get your pencils ready because I have lots of good information on happenings in your area. By the way, if you're listening in Southern California or out of state and you have any news of any important event having to do with writers, email me at linda@manzamedia.com and I'll try to let everybody know about your event. So first, the Sacramento Poetry Center Spring Literary Lecture Series is ongoing. They're doing it early. We're still having winter, I think. But every Thursday night from 7:30 to 9 o'clock through the end of March, you can attend a wonderful lecture. Call Tim Call for information, 916-714-5401. Then, Saturday, March 24th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., Manzanita Writers Press presents Wolf at the Door, a workshop led by award-winning investigative reporter Scott Thomas Anderson, who you just heard recently on this show. Scott will be leading this workshop on literary journalism. For information, go to manzapress.com. Sunday, March 25th at 2 o'clock at the Lodi Library, Donna and Tim Christensen are going to be presenting another of their wonderful Starry Night poetry showcases. Happy Birthday, Vincent van Gogh is the theme, and this will be a really special open mic showcase. They're not going to have a featured poet this time, so you can sign up by contacting Donna or Tim and plan to arrive by 1:45. They're also open to having you sign up for your musical talents if you play acoustic music. Then April 7th in Stockton at the Hagen, there'll be a series of poetry readings on April 7th, and our own Monica Rose will be there reading from her newly published book, River by the Glass. So go and support Monica and the other poets. Saturday, April 14th at 9 o'clock, from 9 o'clock to 3 in the afternoon in Rancho Murrieta, which is on Highway 16 between Sacramento and Jackson, you can join historical novelist Naida West, who's also been a guest on our show a couple of times. She's going to take you on a history and nature walk to discover the real places that are the settings for her novels. Naida has written a trilogy of California historical novels, Eye of the Bear, River of Red Gold, and Rest for the Wicked. The $33 cost includes lunch at the very nice Rancho Murrieta Clubhouse. To reserve your spot, email Naida at wbridgehouse@calweb.com. The Writers Guild Club at San Joaquin Delta College with the San Joaquin Writers Workshop will be sponsoring an all-day workshop from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Featured speaker will be the well-known author Maxine Hong Kingston. And then, in the afternoon, you have two wonderful workshops to choose from. I don't know how you're going to choose, because one will be led by Amy Smith. It'll be on creative nonfiction. The other one, equally exciting, will be led by Indigo Moore, another fiction workshop. Those will go from 2 to 4 p.m. The cost for this day is a mere $35. It includes the workshops, lunch, and Maxine Hong Kingston's reading. And also, if you're a student and you have an ID, you can get this wonderful bargain for $15. So check with the Writers Guild Club at San Joaquin Delta College for more details. And Saturday, May 19th, the San Francisco Book Festival is set for Union Square. They'll be having their outdoor portion of their annual competition honoring the best books of the spring season at Union Square. If you want to know about that, go to sanfranciscobookfestival.com. Well, there you go. We've got tons of things in the area for people who are working on their writing skills. We live in a very thriving, dynamic area. We're so lucky. Okay, now, before we get to our guests, it's time for the morning workout, and I'm going to do a little different, something different today. I thought I'd read to you something that I put on my own website, manzamedia.com. It's on the blog, and I just thought I'd throw it out there, maybe entice you to go and see what else I have on the blog. This is something I wrote just a little while ago. It's called To Believe in Cell Phones and Other Inconvenient Truths. I have a confession. I like some of the TV crime shows. Not all of them, and not usually the most popular. I think I fall for the personalities, the characters. Of course I do. That's what we all do. There's a pretty interesting show on NBC on Thursday nights called Person of Interest, where two good guys, with the help of some very sophisticated technology, identify people who are going to be involved in a serious crime. Trouble is, they can't tell if the person they've identified will be the victim or the perpetrator. But they use the information they have to try to prevent the crime from occurring. One of these guys, the inventor of the technology, stays pretty much in the background, and he acts as the director. He communicates with his partner and gives him the information he needs to know in order to prevent the crime from going down. The partner, who happens to be drop-dead good-looking and speaks softly with a sort of Clint Eastwood, "Go ahead, make my day" voice, is a former Navy SEAL type who can take out five armed men with one hand tied behind his back while he's having his lunch. He does all the tough and dangerous work, protecting the person they think is the intended victim and messing up the plans of the crimesters. On a recent show, the tough, good guy, I never pay attention to his name, to the characters' names, and I know I should, but anyway, he's the tough, good guy. He has just saved the life of a soft, overweight, inner-city high school teacher who witnessed a killing by the Russian mob. Now, the Russian mob is after this teacher, and he's wounded and would be dead except for our hero. In one scene, the hero is leading the teacher out of a tenement building, and they're in terrible danger, and the hero's cell phone has been destroyed in the gun battle. The hero wants to borrow the teacher's cell phone to call the director for information on how to get out of this hopeless mess. But the teacher says he doesn't have a cell phone. His exact words are, "I don't believe in them." It just sort of struck me. He doesn't believe in them? In cell phones? How can he not believe in cell phones? They're everywhere. Oh, I know. He knows they exist. He just doesn't allow one into his life, because he would prefer to live without the benefits and or the irritation of one. I understand. Cell phones can be wonderful, but sometimes they make life difficult because they demand your attention at inconvenient moments. Have you ever had your cell phone go off in a meeting or during a concert or maybe a movie theater at the most tender part of a romantic scene? How embarrassing. How inconvenient. Substitute the word God for cell phone and change some of the situations I illustrated for ones that call for a moral choice. Lots of people say they don't believe in God, but with the beauty of nature and the complexities of living things and the wonders of the universe as evidence, it can be pretty hard to deny God's existence. He's more ubiquitous than cell phones. Maybe what these people are actually saying is that they prefer to live without the benefit and or irritation of God in their lives because he makes us aware of his existence at inconvenient times. He can be downright annoying as he tries to get our attention. Better to let the battery run down and break the connection so you don't hear the call. Then you can get on with your life without all that annoyance. The great thing about cell phones is that if you miss the call, you can always pull up the contact information and use it later. The great thing about God is pretty much the same. You've got the number, you've always had it and always will, and he'll take the call at any time. No batteries or cell phones required. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices, and now we're ready to meet our guests. Today we have the people who started Straight Talk Storytellers in Sacramento with us. That would be Mary Lynn McGrath and her husband, Robin Aurelius. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's really nice to have you with us. Let's see now, who is the one who is behind the origination of Straight Talk Storytellers?
Well, actually, I began to produce this with a library person. Her name is Terry Chekhon. And Terry used to be the director of children's services for the Sacramento City County Libraries. And she's a fabulously good storyteller. She tells both folk tales and everything in life that ever happened to Terry is a story. So she's a great natural-born storyteller. So she and I are in our second year. First year, we told stories at Bell Coolidge Library, but sadly, because of cuts in hours, we lost our evening slot. And Avid Reader was nice enough to host us, so now we're in a well-lit place with lots of good vibes, and we do our storytelling once a month, the first Wednesday of every month at 7 p.m.
And you want everybody to come out. And yes, the Avid Reader is a clean, well-lighted place, wonderful bookstore. I really like it there. So it's great that they've given you the time and the space to do that. About how many people show up as an audience?
Well, we are building back up because we have changed locations. But last month, on February 1st, our theme, and incidentally, every month we have a new theme, and four tellers tell to that theme. And we have a host for every single event. So the February 1st host was Nancy Griffith, and she was responsible to go out and get four tellers. And the theme was love and marriage or not. And I think partly because of the theme, our attendance that night went way up over 50.
Oh,
and 50 is a lot of people to put in a little corner at the Avid Reader.
Yes.
They ended up bringing out every folding chair they had, and there were still people standing. So I think part of it is people have readjusted to our new location.
Mm-hmm.
And also the themes do make a difference. That was a hot one.
Oh, it sure was. Love and marriage
well,
or not.
So well,
yeah.
The
that's
next
right.
One, the sacred spaces, because it's in a time, you know, somewhere around Easter and other remembrances, and people are going to take that seriously, I think.
I think so. A sacred space is going to be another really good topic.
I was actually thinking, though, of St. Patrick's Day in March. When I first began thinking about hosting in March, I thought about the different trips I have made to Ireland and all the kind of investigations I've made of where did my family really live? Could I find their little cabin? Could I find their fields? Could I find the graveyards? You know, all these places that to me are significant and sacred.
Sacred.
Yeah. So I kind of was thinking in terms of St. Patrick. But everybody has a sacred space. It could be your garden.
Mm-hmm.
Could be your chapel.
Mm-hmm.
could be many different things, and everybody has their way of defining that, I think.
Well, like my sacred space happens to be at the organ in my church because I'm an organist.
Oh.
And so when I sit there, I'm really focused on, well, you know, what's the purpose of being here? And also, you know, are these folks sitting out there in the pews, are they getting it?
Yeah. What church do you play for?
Well, right now I'm a member of the Evangelical Friends Church. It's the Friends Community Church, which is Quaker, but it's not like the Quaker meetings. There's two different kinds. One, the meeting, you mostly sit there and you try to find your sacred space within yourself and then talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have anything to say, you just wait until it comes to you. But ours is more like a typical Protestant church where there's much more structure.
I see.
But there's also the sacred space when nobody's saying anything unless they're moved to.
Uh-huh. Interesting. I've never been to one of their meetings. But you play the organ for them, and you also, you're a musical guy.
Well,
you play the accordion.
I've been an accompanist to all kinds of choirs, mostly with churches, but sometime or other, when it's a German holiday, I'll tell you a story about working with Turner Harmony in the 148th year of their existence as a choir under me.
Oh, okay.
Not 148 years under you.
The 148th year.
This man is well preserved.
He really looks good for his age, doesn't he?
He certainly does.
But I do play the accordion, and because I realized I needed to liven things up a little bit. And the accordion gives me a sacred space, too, but because I can really either boost it up and make it very jivey, or I can make it very quiet, you know, and just by opening the bellows up and not pushing hard. Uh-huh. It ends up being a very, very subtle instrument. And so I play for kids, and I give away my time doing that.
Oh, that's great. In fact, you both do a program at the Crocker.
Mm-hmm.
We
do a monthly program at the Crocker. They have the most wonderful program for children, a number of different ones. However, we play for the one called Baby Loves Art. And in this Baby Loves Art, which we do, we did it yesterday, so we do it on Tuesdays. We get very young children and then toddlers, maybe 3 and 4 years old, and we do the music portion. They have themes. The kids make all kinds of interesting art, which generally involves great, big, messy paint projects, thankfully done away from home. And then our job is to match the art experience with music and song, which we like to do. Robin also plays music on a weekly basis for family sing-alongs in our Clooney Clubhouse, which is in McKinley Park, close to the center of town. You know where
the library is.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Family sing-along.
Family sing-alongs, that's true.
Well, that sounds like fun.
Can you sing "I'm a Little Teapot"?
Oh.
I'm a little teapot.
That's
short and sound.
Oh. So beautiful. Yeah. Oh, that was fun.
Yeah.
That's great.
We have fun with it. But our mission with this Straight Talk Storytellers that I think is interesting is we really looked around, because Terry has been a library person for so many years. She knows many librarians. And in the old days, librarians who intended to train and become professional went to school and took a class called storytelling. And so she knows lots of librarians who can tell a story. And I have taught storytelling myself for the last 12 years at Sacramento City College.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a lot of interesting students. Most of the people studying storytelling with me want to use it in their teaching practice. So they will be using it in the classroom. But I've also had lawyers come in who want to polish up their
delivery in the courtroom.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Their summations or whatever it is that they need to interpret as a story. I've had a few preachers come by who worked on the kind of narrative they're going to use when they give a sermon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been an interesting... it's been an interesting 12 years for me teaching these classes, and honestly, one of the surprising things that I found was I would always assign 1 week for the students to create their own story from life. So this meant they were not going to go to a print source and read. They were going to really search their own memory for a story. And when I would tell people this, they'd say, well, you got a bunch of 19 and 20-year-olds in there. What kind of story are they going to have? They haven't lived long enough to have any stories. Surprising.
Oh, yeah. I would think that they would have lots of stories.
They had a lot of stories.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful for me because then I was privy to lots of young life stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that easy, really, to break into a different age group for storytelling. So if your friends are all your peers, they're all of a certain age, you hear their stories being told, but of course young people are not telling you their stories unless there's a reason that they have to share with you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure my own children had lots of stories and they did not tell them to me. It was just,
that's true. There's a bit of a barrier there.
Yeah.
It's too bad.
It is really too bad. It is too bad, but I think it's kind of in the natural course of sharing each other's lives. And
but you're providing a way for them to break through that barrier.
Yeah,
and get this experience and the joy of sharing part of their lives.
That's
people
right.
They wouldn't normally do it with.
That's right. And people will say, "Why do you want to tell a story? You know, what is in it for you?" And what I would tell my students is, one, if you tell a story, you're kind of telling yourself who you are. Because you need to take the time to frame up your story,
mm-hmm.
find out what it is you want to tell,
mm-hmm.
what's important to you, and it's pretty good for self-discovery. And the other part is you want to tell other people who you are.
That's right.
You really want them to know.
I think everybody wants other people to know them.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen, what the baited hook was, you told them that they could put it on their little cell phone camera and make a short clip that could work on Facebook or YouTube without a lot of trouble. And so they all, about half of them said, let's do that. Why, that's a good way to do things.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
A new piece of technology that makes it even more enticing,
yeah.
I think, is be able to put it up on YouTube.
Something good for all of us to learn to do.
True.
Or if it's really good, put it on Vimeo, because then you don't have all the you-know-what clutter.
We don't know what. What?
Well, on Vimeo, you have nothing but really well-done pieces that are thought out, as opposed to just stuff that's, you know, thrown on there. Like in YouTube, you put a tag in there and you get all kinds of junk.
Oh,
that's
yeah,
the only
I
problem.
See. Yeah, that, I suppose you can, yes. What is Vimeo?
Vimeo is just another one of those sites there. You have to, you know, it's free and you can put stuff up on it, but if you put a lot on, you know, like hours, then you got to pay.
Oh.
It's just a semi-pro, I would say, site for people to go to. Vimeo.com. Yeah.
Hmm. I learn something new every day. Okay, well, we'll be back in just a minute to continue talking about Straight Talk Storytellers, and pretty soon we're also going to hear an example of one of the stories. So stay with us. Welcome back to Manzanita Voices. This is Linda Field, and I'm talking with Mary Lynn McGrath and Robin Aurelius about Straight Talk Storytellers. Mary, where do you get the people who come to tell their stories? Why do they want to do it?
I think people have an itch to tell their own stories. They want to tell people who they are, and they want to tell people what they've had, all the events that have been important to them, deeply felt moments in their lives. But we do get a fair amount of storytellers just by contacting friends and finding out who's a good teller. And in doing that and asking around about it, we came up with a nice list of tellers. And the interesting part for us, and we really try for this, is we try to cross the generations so that we get young, old, and in between. We think that's a very, very nice mix and a really good thing to do with storytelling. And then we know that celebrities and politicians often have a chance to tell their stories. They're being interviewed and they get a lot of press time and air time. But we really reach out and try to find people who don't often have a chance to be heard. They aren't asked to tell their stories and they aren't heard, of course. And another thing that we have found that's pretty interesting in our own peer groups, when we get together and tell stories for fun, is we're such a nation of interrupters.
Yes, we are.
Anytime you're right in the middle of something good or at a party, and people think nothing of cutting in.
Oh, don't say so.
So to guarantee, which we do, tell her that you will have 10 minutes. That's our top limit. You'll have 10 minutes to tell your story, and no one will interrupt you. You'll be able to have that time to tell what you want to say. That's a big enticement to some people. And I was going to mention that I had asked a lot of people to tell, including ex-Mayor Phil Eisenberg, who is a good storyteller. And when you're asking someone who's well-known to tell a story, you have to talk with them about humility. Because even though they're well-known and people know that they're good tellers, you never know in an evening's program who might really step up and be a star. The fact that you're a celebrity doesn't necessarily mean that your story is going to be a better story or that you're able to tell it any better than the kid who dishes up your French fries at McDonald's. So it's a very humbling experience for some people because they come, you know, prepared to tell, and they're used to being at the front of the line. But our big thing is to give everybody a chance to tell and be heard if they've got a good story and they can tell it well.
And we have a good story coming up. Regina Brink is, we're going to play her story. And this is a recording that was made at the Avid Reader when Regina was delivering her work. And I do want to remind you, the listeners, that this is a place of business. There were customers walking about and chatting with each other. So you're going to have some ambient noise in the background. But it will not detract at all, I think, from Regina's delivery because she's a feisty woman.
She's an exciting teller, and she tells the story of a young child who is blind.
Herself.
She is learning to use the white cane, and her family is preparing to let her go out into the world. Just imagine.
Yeah.
Your little girl going out into the world with a white cane, and then the surprising things she does to be just like the other kids.
It's a real good story. I think you folks will enjoy it.
Thank you for that introduction. So I'm just going to go ahead and tell you that Terry is going to be signaling me if time starts to come up toward the end. So she's going to tap her foot. So please, everyone, don't start tapping their feet. Do anything else but tap your foot. Okay. So thank you, Terry, for that sweet introduction, and I am Regina Brink, and I have been blind, totally blind, since the age of 2 years old when I had retinoblastoma, which attacks the retina, and it's a type of cancer. But my parents didn't know any blind people, but they just knew that they wanted me to have as normal a life as any other kid, just to be like another kid. Normal's not a popular word anymore, but it was when I was growing up. And they just wanted me to have the same experience that other kids have, to feel equal to other children. And they were pretty strong about that. And my mom and dad advocated for me to be in regular school, mainstream school, at a time when that was considered a pilot project. And now you guys might be familiar, your teachers and librarians and people in that field, you might know that that's become more commonplace to have people with a disability mainstreamed. But they wanted to send me to residential schools at the time, and my parents fought that, and they fought to get me in the drama class, even the home economics class, so that I could take all the classes that all the other kids did, and they would tell everybody that I could do just about anything I set my mind to. And there were most of the things my parents trained me to do, like cleaning house and cooking. My dad would close his eyes, my mom would watch him, and they would figure out together how to teach me it. I wish I could have been around. That must have been hilarious when I think back on it. but they set out to do this, and the consequences of that, I don't think they were too much aware of, because I felt just like all the other kids. I climbed trees, I ran around with my brothers, we got into fights, we did all those things that kids do, and including maybe some of the things my parents wish I hadn't done, or and that's what this is about. Well, one of the things my parents couldn't teach me, they couldn't teach me Braille, So the school taught me that. They also couldn't teach me cane travel. And they weren't too sure they even liked the white cane. Because, of course, then that kind of heralded that I was blind when I came down the road. But they agreed that it was safer if I was going to be out on the road and that kind of thing for me to have a cane and to be safe. And one of the things that the teacher asked is that I be allowed to go in the neighborhood by myself with my cane certain places. And so they probably gritted their teeth and said, okay. So one of the things I learned to do very first off was to walk to TikTok Market, a little corner market. And the guy that ran the market was kind of mean. His name was Mr. Jack. And that's what we called him anyway. And he was mean. He was mean to the kids. He's like, what are you doing in here? That's the way he talked always. He sounded like someone that always growled when he talked. But he knew that I couldn't see, and I would come in by myself. And one of the things is he didn't let you touch anything unless you were going to buy it. You're going to buy that? You know. You couldn't touch anything. But I would be allowed to touch the candy bars and stuff to figure out which one I wanted. And they would say, Mr. Jack, she's touching the candy. He'd say, she can't see. That's why she's touching it. Stay away from it. No. So I went up one day and I thought to myself, Mr. Jack's busy with the customer. He's showing that guy something. No one else is in the store. I don't have any money, really. I could just slip this candy bar into my pocket. He'd never see it. Bet I could do it. So I listened really carefully, made sure that they were turned away from me, their voices weren't toward me, made sure no one had come in the door, and I slipped that candy bar into my pocket. And I waited. And Mr. Jack didn't yell. In fact, he's like, you find what you wanted over there. And I said, oh, I don't want a candy bar today, Mr. Jack. I'm going home. So I turned around to walk outside the door. Now, the other thing that happened is I was raised in a church where they didn't have Braille. And so the nuns in the church taught me my catechism live. So I would go for catechism lessons with Sister De La Rosa every once a week, and she would teach me my catechism. Well, she taught a lot about the devil, and I knew the devil well, I thought. He was a big guy, looked kind of crazy, wore red, and he had a big old pitchfork, and he pursued bad little girls. So as I'm walking home, I was sure he was there. I was positive, and I could hear him, Regina. And I'd walk a little farther and I'd hear it again. I know what you did. I'm terrified now. And I try to walk home, but it's scarier and scarier. He's coming closer and closer. So finally I turn around and I run back. I even think I hit a couple poles. I just kept running and I got all the way back to the store. I come in breathless and I say, Mr. Jack, I have to give this back to you. He's like, What is it? I took this. And I start crying. Well, don't cry. You can have it. Don't worry about it. No, I don't want it. Take it. I wasn't taking that candy bar because the devil attached to that candy bar. So he called my mother because he said, I don't know what's wrong with your daughter here. You know, she's up in my store crying and I don't know what's going on with her. Well, I started walking home and I started to walk quickly and then I started to think about my mother. I started to slow down. I didn't want to face my mother anytime soon because Mr. Jack called her because I was crying in the store. I heard him calling when I walked out. Oh, boy. So I thought, God, which was worse, the devil or mom? Which is worse? I took as long as I could to get home. I finally walked in the store and into the door of my house. And my mother, she was typical of her day. She was pretty strict, and they didn't mind pulling out a belt and deciding to teach you something with it. So, it's like I said, it's not politically correct today, but it was how it was done back then. And so I was sure, like, I was ready. I was like, I know. You know, I know she's going to get the belt. I'm ready for it, and I'm just going to figure out how to take it, and I'm not going to cry.
Right.
So I get in there, and she says, so you have something you want to tell me? I said, Mr. Jack called you? She said, I want to hear it from you. And I said, I took a candy bar from his store. She said, why would you do that? I would pay for it. You could have asked me for some money for a candy bar. I said, I don't know. I just wanted to be like all the other kids. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, you know what happens when you do things like that. I said, I know I'm in big trouble. And she said, well, seems like you've suffered enough. You seemed pretty upset, pretty scared. But I'm just wanting to know, what made you return that candy bar? And I said, the devil made me do it.
Well, I just love Regina's story. She is wonderful.
That's for sure.
Now, Mary, you say that you actually teach this
yes.
at City College. And you mentioned to me when we were talking between sessions here that there are four basic things that you teach that people should do when they are preparing a story to tell.
Well, one of the things that I talk about with my students when they're creating their own story is you're creating the content and you are discovering the meaning really of your story through multiple tellings of it. More and more comes out to you. But when you're putting your story together, there are different levels you can go to with it. You can tell about something that happened in your life and just describe it the way a newspaper article would describe something. Who, what, when, where, and why.
Mm-hmm.
That. Then if you want to go deeper, you can add the thoughts and feelings you experienced while you went through it. So real-time kind of thoughts and feelings. Or to take it even deeper, you may say, and over the years I've thought about this story, and with the passage of time, now I think what really happened was, so the insights you get as you get older and think back on your wild youth. And then finally, you might even offer a lesson, like the thing I really learned as I reflected on this over time. And you can share something that might really be of interest and use to others who are going to go through a situation like that. Those are the ways that you can make something kind of universal out of your story. It doesn't just describe an incident in your life, but it's something other people can relate to and learn something from. That's important for the content of your story. And as far as a presentation of it, I think an interesting thing about storytelling is that since you're not reading aloud and you don't have a book in your hand,
mm-hmm.
you really can use the full complement of language. So not only do you have words, but you have gesture and facial expression.
Mm-hmm.
So people are watching your face. They're watching what you're doing with your body. You can use sound in your story, and kids have a lot of fun with sound and make all kinds of sounds and enjoy any little character voice that you may use in telling your story. And the emotional tone in your voice. I think it's easy to get to the emotional tone if you're not reading aloud because you have no barrier between yourself, your face, your voice, and those people looking back at you. They see your eyes. They see your face. It's easy to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And then your attitude is part of your telling. When you're a teller, how do you feel about yourself up there? How do you feel about the audience? How do you feel about the content of your material? Very, very important. More than I can say, the attitude you take with you when you step up there to be the teller. And finally, when you're a teller, you really get feedback from the audience. And as a writer, I love to go back and forth between telling and writing so that I write down what I think I'm going to tell. I do not memorize it. I noticed that you used the word memorized. Most of our tellers don't memorize.
They don't memorize.
They only prepare an opening and closing sentence or two, so they're not searching for those words. But everything else, everything in between, is improvised and comes from their own memory of what happened. So it's way more spontaneous, and that way when the audience is digging it and you're looking at them, you know, and their eyes are on you and they're smiling and they've lit up because you've brought them to life in your story, you're really fed by that.
Yeah.
So if you're permitting this to happen, if you can respond to audience feedback, you just get better and better. Better and better while you're telling. So these are things that we pass along to students of storytelling.
Uh-huh. That would be a great feeling. And yeah, the feedback from the audience would be fantastic. And I know when I do readings of my work, when I read a short story or a section from my book before in front of an audience, I try to remember to make eye contact. But the more eye contact I make, then the more likely I am to lose my place in the piece. So it's more difficult.
It's a different skill.
Yeah.
It's a different skill. There are people who do beautiful read alouds, and they're skilled. Mm-hmm. They've learned the skills and the components that make it beautiful.
Yeah, make it sound natural.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're just up there and you've got your opening line and your closing mm-hmm. line in your mind, but then everything else is spontaneous,
mm-hmm. yeah.
I bet that's really entertaining.
It's heady stuff.
Well, now, let's see, Robin's been sitting over there really quiet, but he has a story to tell, and it's about a place that's dear to my heart because I'm from Western New York. I grew up in Ellicottville and Salamanca, and just down the road, down Route 17 to the west, was Chautauqua. And Robin grew up there. It's pretty amazing. Small world.
Well, my parents bought a summer house there, and it was kind of their pride and joy because it was one of the oldest houses, 1880 or so. And my mother had always had a tradition in the family of owning houses that were, by our standards, pretty marginal, you know, like the balloon framing. And she used
balloon
to have one,
framing,
yeah,
what's that?
That's one without any bracing. It's just straight, you know, vertical sticks, you know, go all the whole height of the two-story house, and they just nail it together as quick as possible because all it is a summer cabin and doesn't have to have a snow load or anything. But they do have a steep pitched roof, so it's not going to fall down. But anything else you do there, they won't let you remodel it, and they won't let you put any cross bracing in, and none of these little, you know, hangers and stuff that we use today take for granted when we build the house.
Oh, like joist hangers and things.
Yeah,
like
so
that.
Here was an old historical house, very, very beautiful with beautiful windows, and people would they leave the windows open, and they would wave to you as they walked by because they knew you who you were and everything. Well, anyway, my mother loved the house, but she really wanted to have. Not to have to send her laundry out, you know, and get it folded and wonder when it's coming back. So she asked my dad, can we put our washing machine in a very primitive kind of a dryer, ran on 110, fortunately, because there was no 220 in Chautauqua. It wasn't ever going to be any 220. So they let him. Nobody was going to let you do anything, but you had to kind of do it and hope nobody found out. So we put the washing machine and the dryer in a room on the first floor. And sooner or later, somebody looked in while the windows were open, and they heard this noise of a dryer and stuff, and they stuck their head in, and saying, you know, what's that? And my mother said, it's my dryer. And the neighbor said, well, you're not supposed to have any of this stuff here, because these are period houses, and what would people think, you know, if they walked by and hear this convenience? So my mother was just shocked about this, and she talked to my dad, and she said, Bill, what are we going to do about this? My dad's name was Bill. And Dad said, oh, we'll figure it out, because he was the kind of guy who could do just about anything. He was a jack of all trades and a guy that grew up in, you know, Minnesota, and he could do anything. So But then he asked me, because I had been an engineering student and I was just visiting, and I had some laundry that I needed doing, so I had already thrown it in the washing machine. It was a wonderful old Bendix machine, you know, the front loader type. Well, anyway, so, and then my mother turned it on, and then my dad said, you know, watch out, close the windows, don't want anybody knowing we're washing it. I said, well, what else can we do? And then Dad said to me, well, we got this spare room up in the attic that no, we're not even using it. We put it up there, and I said, Dad, you got to be nuts. I said, this framing won't take it. And I went up there, and we pushed on the framing, and we thought, uh-oh, we'd have to brace it. But so we took them up there anyway. They would just barely fit up there into the room, and then we tried, you know, plugging them in again and running it again. And so they started to really shake the whole house, like, uh-oh, you know, this house might, you know, loosen up and some of the shingles fall off, and then we'd be in real trouble. We'd have to, you know, figure out something else. So we noodled around a little bit, and then finally we decided, well, maybe we could brace it from the inside using cables and turnbuckles and other things that, you know, we went to the hardware store. He knew all about hardware stores, so we just bought a big pile of stuff, and we started to tighten up all the joists and all the rafters, and finally we turned it on again, and still wasn't quite right. So I said to him, this was my suggestion, why don't we just hang it, you know, from the rafters? And then he said, well, I guess we could do that. So we went back to the hardware store and bought four door springs, you know, from a garage door. And we basically made a platform, and we hung each of those machines from it. And by God, they really worked. And I want to tell you that when I checked back, you know, this was 50 years ago. When I checked back, you know what? That those machines were still there. They were still working, and they were still secret. And that's my story. My mother was really happy.
If Mom was happy, then that's what we want. Oh, my goodness. That sounds like a Fibber McGee story.
Guaranteed not to be a fib, though, right?
Right.
Absolutely.
Oh, my gosh. That is fun. Have you told that story of the avid reader?
No, I probably will, though, if we have one of do-it-yourself, right? Because that's the perfect answer. When no one else will let you take a permit out, and you have to do it yourself.
Yeah, I know about permits and adding on and braces and all that stuff, but it's in another life. Okay, well, we're just about out of time, but I want to thank you both so much, and I hope that everybody who lives in the Sacramento area is going to save the first Wednesday evening of every month to go to the Avid Reader. At 7 o'clock, right? 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock.
Avid Reader. I mean, you've got the Tower Cafe right across the street.
Oh, yeah, and afterwards we all go over.
Oh, do you?
And we have a sinful dessert.
Some of us have a sinful snack and a sinful dessert.
Yes.
Oh, yes, a whole meal.
And a sinful tall pear cider.
Mm.
Oh, pear
24
cider?
24-ounce glass.
So good.
Oh,
yeah.
My. I haven't had their pear cider.
Yeah, you're going to have to try that. And parking is really easy. Lots of parking. A lot right there.
That's right. At the
reader.
At the Avid Reader, and across the street at the Tower Theater and Cafe, and then of course you can go to a late movie too, because the Tower Theater has, well, everybody who lives in the Sacramento area knows about the Tower.
That's right.
It's a wonderful place. Mm-hmm. So first Wednesday of every month, 7 p.m. Go to hear the Straight Talk Storytellers. The theme for March, which will be March 7th, is A Sacred Space. April 4th, the theme is Gardening in My Genes.
With a G-E-N-E-S.
Runs in the family. And in May, the topic will be My Family and Other Animals.
Mm-hmm.
So get your thinking caps on. Contact Mary. Let's see. Well, let's give some contact information,
okay.
Mary.
Before I do that, I want to thank you very much, Linda, for having us and giving us a chance to talk about Straight Talk. We love it.
Oh,
we're so glad we got to come and to meet you, too.
I'm so glad you came. This
has
been wonderful.
And our contact information, I can give you my email and Terry Chekhon's email. Mine is, what the heck? Mine is StorytellerMcGrath@yahoo.com. And could you read Terry's for me?
Yes, I will. It's her first name is Terry, so it's T and then Chekhon, her last name, C-H-E-K-O-N. So it's T-C-H-E-K-O-N at AOL.com.
Yeah.
And then there's a cell phone, 916-531-4110. I answer it, and if you happen to be lost or anything, I'll tell you how to get there.
Great. Okay. And everybody, remember to go to my website, manzamedia.com, to hear this information and all the other information I read in Datebook. And check out my blog, please, and maybe even look at my work in progress. Let me know what you think. Give me some feedback. I would love that. Thank you for joining us today. It was a pleasure having you with us. I hope you'll come back and see us again next week at Manzanita Voices.
You've been listening to Manzanita Voices, a production of the Manzanita Writers Press, an affiliate of the Calaveras County Arts Council.